Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the fourth of Landmark Chambers' Introduction to Rating series. Today, we're going to be diving into the arcane and peculiar world of rating valuation. To take us through that, we've got two absolutely fantastic speakers. We've got Jacqueline Lean, who's an established practitioner in the rating field. She's done a number of really interesting valuation cases, including the Celsa Steel case in the Upper Tribunal. And with her, we have Tim Mould, Queen's Counsel, a name that will be known to very many of you. Tim appeared in the Supreme Court only last month in the ATMs litigation and has done a very great many valuation cases. He's a real expert in this field. Before I hand over to them, just a reminder of the format of this. Tim and Jacqueline will be speaking to you for around about half an hour, after which we'll have a few minutes for questions. Down at the bottom of the screen on Zoom, there's the chat button. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask the speakers, please just pop them in the chat and submit them to everyone. When we get to the end of the session, we'll pull out as many as we have time for and address those at the end. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to, I think, Tim's going first. Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you, Luke. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this short session on valuation for rating. Jacqueline and I have divided our time into two broad themes. I'm going to deal firstly with the valuation framework, and then Jacqueline will deal with valuation techniques or methods. We start with a simple point that the ratepayer's rates bill, that is to say the amount that the ratepayer is required to pay, is calculated on the basis of the rateable value shown in the current local rating list for the hereditament which the ratepayer occupies. And that is the effect of sections 43 and 44 of the governing statute, the Local Government Finance Act 1988. So how is the rateable value to be determined? And the answer is by applying the rules set out in Schedule 6 to the Local Government Finance Act, which is the valuation schedule. And in particular, paragraph 2 of Schedule 6 tells us how the rateable value of a hereditament is to be determined. It's so fundamental that I shall take the trouble to read out to you some words from paragraph 2, subparagraph 1. They are these: the rateable value of a non-domestic hereditament shall be taken to be an amount equal to the rent at which it is estimated the hereditament might reasonably be expected to let from year to year. Moving away from the statutory language to a more simple formulation, the rateable value of a hereditament is determined on the basis of its annual letting value, which we practitioners know as the hypothetical tenancy. And the valuation framework laid down by Schedule 6 is known to practitioners as the rating hypothesis. Now, these rules, like so much of rating, are of considerable vintage, and the annual letting value basis for establishing the rateable value of a hereditament was first introduced by the Parochial Assessments Act of 1836, which was, as it happens, the final year of George in England. It was the last full year of the reign of William IV. It was the year in which the Grand National was first run. It was the year in which Charles Dickens published his first novel, The Pickwick Papers. That gives you an idea of the vintage of this particular method of establishing value. The purpose of the rating hypothesis was pithily explained in a case called Port of London Authority and Orsett Union, decision of the House of Lords from 1920. And the following short statement of principle is worth noting. It is in respect of his occupation that the rate is levied, And the standard in the Act is nothing but a means of finding out what the value of that occupation is for the purposes of the assessment. So rateable value, or annual letting value, is the standard by which every hereditament in the country can be measured in relation to every other hereditament. It's not seeking to establish the true value of any particular hereditament, but rather its value in comparison with the respective values of other hereditaments up and down the land. And that is to ensure that everybody is rated or taxed on a uniform basis. And you can see that explained in the case called Dawkins against Ash Brothers and Heaton, another decision of the House of Lords of more recent vintage, dating from 1969. In order to ensure that the standard is applied uniformly, the rating hypothesis rests upon certain assumptions about the hypothetical tenancy, and they are these. Firstly, the tenancy is assumed to begin on a prescribed valuation date, conventionally under the modern statute, 2 years prior to the date on which the rating list is compiled and comes into force. The second assumption is that the tenancy is granted on full repairing and insuring terms. The third is that the tenancy is from year to year with a reasonable prospect of continuance. The fourth is that a tenancy is to be assumed even in the case of very many properties in which such a letting would never in fact occur. A large chemical works is never going to be let on an annual tenancy, but it must be valued for rating purposes on the assumption that it is. And the fifth assumption is that the whole world, including the actual occupier, is in the market for the tenancy. And in many cases, the actual occupier will be the person who sets the value of the tenancy in the market. For example, in the case of a major department store such as Harrods in West London, it's inconceivable that anybody other than the actual Harrods would actually be in the market to let the premises on the hypothetical tenancy. And so it is on the basis of the value of the premises to Harrods that the rateable value was set by the Upper Tribunal Lands Chamber in a case decided by them back in 2007. By contrast, the thing to be valued is the actual hereditament, the actual unit of rateable property as it stands, with all its essential characteristics that work to its advantage or disadvantage. Again, that principle was pithily explained in the Orsett Union case. Now, many of you will have heard mention of the Rebus principle. That's shorthand for Rebus sic stantibus, which is a Latin phrase meaning literally things being taken as they are. That phrase was explained in another case called Robinson Brothers in 1937 in this way. In weighing up the evidence of value, it is the duty of the valuer to take into account every intrinsic quality and every intrinsic circumstance which tends to push the rental value either up or down. The property to be valued is the real property, and it is to be valued in the market circumstances as at the date which is prescribed for that purpose. The Rebus principle is now set on a statutory basis, and the statutory basis is to be found in paragraphs 2, subparagraphs 6 and 7 of Schedule 6 to the Local Government Finance Act. In the interests of uniformity, the physical and functional state of the hereditament and of its locality are taken to be as they are found to be at the date of compilation of the rating list. That is known as the material day. In a case where the rateable value needs to be revisited during the lifetime of a rating list because of a material change in the circumstances of the hereditament in question, then the material day is the date on which that change occurred. For an authoritative explanation of the Rebus principle and its application, I refer you to the case of Williams and Scottish and Newcastle Breweries, a decision of the Court of Appeal in 2001. There are certain other assumptions to be made about the hereditament. The first is that immediately before the tenancy begins, the hereditament is in a state of reasonable repair. The second is that all processed plant and machinery has been removed from the hereditament. And the third is that the hereditament is offered to market, vacant, and indeed to let. Now, before I move on to the remainder of what I want to say, I'm going to hand over to Jacqueline, who's going to tell us briefly about some recent case law on the repairing assumption.
Thanks, Tim, and good afternoon, everybody. Apologies if you're getting some background sound from me. Sun's out, windows are open, music is cranked up down in sunny South London. The case I wanted to pick up on in particular, and it's the leading case on dealing with the repairing assumption, is a case of Monk and Newbiggin, which was a 2017 decision of the Supreme Court. And essentially the issue for the court in that case was, what about where you've got a building or a commercial set of offices that's in the course of being redeveloped? Can you rate that? Do you treat that, or do you treat that as not rateable, not capable of beneficial occupation? It's got a zero or a nominal amount of an RV. Or do you apply the statutory assumption in paragraph two that Tim has been talking about? Do you assume that it's in a state of repair? And the Court of Appeal in that case has sort of taken the view that there were these statutory assumptions and you applied them. But the Supreme Court said, well, no, you can't. The ratings have always been based on this principle of reality. Yes, there are various assumptions you make to help you with the valuation in the hypothetical situation, but it doesn't displace the fact that what you're actually valuing is what is there, what are the premises. So they outlined, well, actually it was outlined in submissions from the Association of Rating Surveyors, and the Supreme Court sort of adopted it. So it's a three-stage process when you're dealing with a case where what's in issue is this property that's under redevelopment, where the proposer is asking for the value to be reduced. And the three stages to that. First is, you've got to look at whether the property as it is on that date is capable of beneficial occupation. Whether it's a hereditament at all, essentially, could somebody actually occupy it? If it is a hereditament, then you look at the modal category of the occupation that can be made of it. And both of those, that's where you're applying the reality principle, i.e. is anybody realistically going to be occupying a building that's been stripped out, the ceiling's been taken out, there's no sanitary facilities, all the services have been stripped out, it's basically an empty shell. And then the third point is, well, if you assume you've got to, yes, hereditament capable of beneficial occupation, then you go on to look at whether the property's in a reasonable state of repair, and that's where the statutory assumption comes in. And the court also made the practical point that even if you sort of get to point one or point two and say, well, actually it's not capable of beneficial occupation because frankly it's an empty shell with nothing, that doesn't necessarily mean you should just alter the list, to call it, or take it out of the list. There's a, in practice, the valuation officer had a practice of just essentially adjusting the rateable value of it. So you kept the hereditament in, you just adjusted the value, and they said nothing that they said in the Supreme Court judgment should detract from that useful practice. How do you ascertain whether or not a property is of that type, that it's going under a scheme of redevelopment or reconstruction that means that it's not capable of beneficial occupation, as opposed to it just being in a state of disrepair where repairs need to be done to it? Two key points came out of the Supreme Court's judgment. Firstly, the subjective intention of the freeholder just isn't relevant. This is an objective question. Looked at objectively on the material date, is this property subject to a scheme of redevelopment or reconstruction? And secondly, the valuation officer can have regard to a programme of works associated with what's going on. So you don't necessarily just go in and look at it and say, well, this isn't this. You can look at that programme of works that are taking place in respect of the property. A really useful application of the Supreme Court's decision in Monk is a fairly recent decision of the Upper Tribunal in Jackson and Canary Wharf Limited. So that's a 2019 decision of the Upper Tribunal Lands Chamber. And that was to do with one of these multi-storey buildings in Canary Wharf, where the landlord had a practice of letting out obviously separate floors to different companies and let the building as a whole. I think it was at least 46 stories high, so probably that's understandable. But when tenants went out of occupation, his practice was to strip back the floors that they'd been occupying to essentially a shell state, with a view to the tenant, when a new lease was signed, being able to go in, fit them out to their own requirements and specifications. And the question was there does this become a heritagement that's not capable of beneficial occupation, so that you go down to the rateable value of nil or merely nominal? Or is this in the statutory repair, statutory assumption type category? And it was a fairly categorical answer by the Upper Tribunal, looking at everything that was going on, and you could look at the past practice of what happened, that this was one that was undergoing redevelopment or reconstruction. But those are just two quite useful cases to look at in terms of, firstly, the principles and the approach, and then also how those are being applied by the Lands Tribunal.
Thank you, Jack.
Back to you.
So just wrapping up on the question of the framework, the question posed by paragraph 2 of the sixth schedule to the Act is as follows. What is the rent at which the hereditament might reasonably be expected to let from year to year in its physical and functional state at the material day, but otherwise in the actual market at the prescribed valuation date? Now, that is a question of fact and not of law. It's the job of specialist valuation surveyors to answer it. Rating lists are compiled and maintained by valuation officers. The interests of ratepayers are served by rating surveyors. If those specialists cannot agree, the valuation dispute is resolved by a specialist tribunal, the Valuation Tribunal for England, and on appeal from that body, the Upper Tribunal Lands Chamber. In the Robinson Brothers case to which I referred earlier, the court said this: the objective is the real value of the actual hereditament. The inquiry is primarily economic and not legal. To reinforce that, the following are established in the case law. Firstly, there is no statutory prescribed method of valuation. Secondly, there's no statutory prescribed Bible of valuation evidence. Thirdly, decisions of the tribunals are not binding. Fourthly, the appropriate method or methods of valuation must be determined by the valuers in the light of the circumstances. And fifthly, as established in a case in the Court of Appeal in 1969 called Garton and Hunter, all methods of valuation are in principle admissible. Jacqueline is now going to run briefly through those methods of valuation that are well established from previous decisions.
Thanks, Tim. And again, a case that's a very useful go-to for an overview of these is a 2017 decision of the Upper Tribunal Lands Chamber of Hughes Valuation Officer and York Museums and Gallery Trust. A case that Tim would be very familiar with, considered a number of different points of principle, but particularly after about paragraph 100, gives a very, very useful overview of the core methods of valuation and when you might use them and what their various advantages and disadvantages are. But by way of summary, as Tim began by saying at the outset of this webinar, what you're looking at is what would be the hypothetical rent for this property on a hypothetical tenancy. So the starting point will often, depending on the situation, be the rental evidence. Where reliable rental evidence is available, then that is something that the tribunal will look at, or something that the valuers will look at in trying to decide on what is the appropriate rateable value. Now, obviously, you just can't take that as is, because we're looking at the hypothetical. We're not looking at the what is the rent actually passing under the lease, and that translates to the rateable value. But as been made clear in a case known called Lotus and Delta against Culverwell, you can take the rent as a starting point, but what you've got to do is look at the circumstances under which that rent has been agreed. And you've got to look at that both in terms of time and also in terms of how it may correlate to the various statutory assumptions. Now, clearly, the closer the situation correlates to the statutory assumptions and the time scale that you're looking at as to when the date that you're looking at, the stronger the weight you may well be able to give to that evidence. Similarly, you'll want to look at comparables, so rent passing or rateable values for other units or hereditaments similar to the one you're valuing. Probably in the locality, it depends exactly on the circumstances. But again, you need to look at those and depending on how much you need to adjust them to either reflect the circumstances of the hereditament you're valuing or the situation you're dealing with, the less weight you will be able to give them. Conversely, you might be able to give greater weight if you've got to make fewer adjustments to either make it reflective of this hereditament or the statutory assumptions. So the starting point is, let's look and see what rental evidence is available, both in respect of this unit and also in respect of other similar type hereditaments. Now, what do you do if this is not a unit that has a passing rent or the sort of property for which there is a rent? And Tim mentioned their sort of chemical plants. I've certainly dealt with it in the context of steelworks and an artificial fibres work, which I didn't know what that was until I had to go and do a site visit. But what do you do in that situation where there isn't a market for or established rents on the market for these type of properties? Well, I said now it's useful to turn to the York Museums and Gallery Trust, because as the tribunal tells us in that case, where you don't think you've got reliable rental evidence, then you have to go and look at what are the methods you might use to arrive at an appropriate valuation for this hereditament in question. And if I can just pause there, I know we've got to be slightly conscious of time, but I hoped you'd forgive me if I shared with you what is one of my favourite opening paragraphs for any case ever, which was in the York Museums Trust case, which starts on the 7th of April, 1739. So on my maths, that's 281 years ago today. Dick Turpin was taken from a cell in York Castle to the city gallows in Knavesmere, where he was hanged for the theft of three horses. He is said to have put on a good show, dressing in a new frock coat, bowing to spectators, and paying £3.10 for the services of five professional mourners. So a little bit of a historic factual evidence as to what was going on this day a while ago. I digress. So in that case, in addition to setting out a rather wonderful history of York Museum, the tribunal went through each of the different commonly used different valuation methods where you can't rely on rental evidence. The first that the one I was going to address was something called the contractor's basis. And the contractor's basis of valuation is one you can use where the comparative method is impossible. And essentially, it's based on a fiction of what it would cost, what the costs would be for the tenant to build his own property, what build his own inheritance to carry on that business from. So it's a five-stage process. Firstly, you look at an estimation of the replacement cost of the building, including site works and rateable plant, i.e. so what would be the estimated costs to build this type of factory building today. Second stage, you've got to adjust that, because obviously what you're valuing is the property as is, whereas what you've estimated is the cost of a brand new building. So stage two is there'll be some adjustments to allow for things like physical obsolescence and age, maintenance responsibilities, things like that. Stage three, you've then got to look at the capital value of the land that the factory or the building stands on, because you obviously have to put the value of the land with the costs of the new building to get that overall capital value of the hereditament. Then there is you effectively decapitalize that combined value of the buildings and the land. And please know that is at a rate prescribed by statute. I think the Upper Tribunal described this stage in the York Museum case as being the only bit where you don't really have to employ professional judgment. You can just apply a rate that's set down in statute. And then stage five, which is often a very controversial stage, certainly in the cases I've dealt with, which is it's essentially a review of where you get to look at whether that seems to be about right in terms of the hereditament you're dealing with. It's often called the step back and look. And it's where you can bring in things like locality, surrounding area, and the economic factors that may mean that the figure you've arrived at doesn't reflect what would seem to be a reasonable value for that hypothetical, for that hereditament. So that's a very broad overview of the contractor's basis. And where I've commonly seen that used is things like steelworks, industrial plants, for which there isn't a common market. Another valuation method that's sometimes used is called the receipts and expenditures method. And in essence, this is quite often useful where there is a premises where probably the value of that building to the tenant lies less in its value per se, but more about what profit they can make from that building in that location. So in terms, it started off in the context of statutory undertakers plant. It's commonly now used for things like pubs and clubs, because those are businesses. The value of the premises to them is less about the value of the property, and it's more about the profit that they can realise from trading in that, from that building in that location. So essentially, in a very rough and ready terms, the receipts and expenditure is done by assessing the gross receipts which a potential tenant could expect to achieve from operating that type of business in that location, and then taking away operational expenditure for that, allowing some for capital return and profit, and then looking at what surplus might be left over and looking at to that surplus to try and sort of with a view to identifying it as, this would be how much a hypothetical tenant would be willing to pay in rent in order to realize that profit from that property. So as I said, it started with statutory undertakers. It's moved on to pubs and clubs. And again, there's a lot more detail in the York Museum case about what exactly you might look at and how you might go about doing that. There's also something called a shortened receipts approach, which is essentially a less intensive form of a slightly shorthand version of the receipts and expenditures methodology in terms of the depth it's looked at in, but I won't take up any more time with that. And I think, Tim, that just leaves one point left over that I think you were going to pick up on, which is this concept known as tone of the list.
Yes, the tone of the list is an approach which has been approved by the tribunals, and which essentially resorts to assessments of rateable value in the list in question, which have become so settled by reference ultimately to the rental evidence that has been deployed to compile the list at the outset, that those assessments themselves can properly and reliably be taken to be evidence of value for the purposes of resolving a dispute about the valuation of a hereditament that bears similar characteristics to those of the hereditaments that are within those settled assessments. That then completes, Luke, the brief survey of the framework and of valuation methods. The matter can perhaps be summed up best in this way. In practice, whichever method of valuation you're considering, you should be able to justify it in the light of the facts of the case, not merely because it has been used by others. And if one wishes to see recent authority for that proposition, look no further than the very recent decision of the Upper Tribunal Lands Chamber in another museum's case, the case of Hughes against Exeter City Council, which was decided at the very beginning of the current year.
Thank you very much, Tim and Jacqueline, for an absolutely fantastic half an hour. Rating valuation is one of those subjects that's of just endless fascination as far as I'm concerned. It's always brilliant to hear the principles gone over so authoritatively. So I thank you both very much for that. We've got a few really interesting questions here. I'm going to try to pick out a handful of them. The first question relates to the use of a hereditament for valuation purposes. When you have the actual tenant using the property in one way, what do you assume the hypothetical tenant is going to use the property for? Would one of you like to have a stab at explaining that and the concept of mode or category for us?
Yes, I'll have a go. The authoritative statement of principle in relation to that question is now to be found in the case of Williams and Scottish and Newcastle Breweries, decision of the Court of Appeal in 2001 that I mentioned earlier. But essentially, for valuation purposes, the use of the heredisement is the use to which it is put by the occupier at the material day. So where the heredisement is being valued under Schedule 6 for the purposes of compiling the rating list, one looks at the mode and category of use of the heredisement. Is it used as a shop? Is it used as a factory? Whatever it may be, as at that date, and one values on the basis that that is the use for which it is being marketed on the hypothetical tenancy.
Thanks very much, Tim. Next question, I think I'm gonna send Jacqueline's way because it relates to the receipts and expenditure method. We've got a question about how you deal with an actual occupier who is unusually good or presumably unusually bad at delivering their business that they operate from the premises. So if you've got a pub, say, and the actual tenant is performing way above market norms, what would you do within the receipts and expenditure method to avoid overvaluing that premises and effectively valuing the business rather than the property?
Well, I think the starting point for that is, again, to stress that what is being looked at is a hypothetical tenant. So although the starting point that will be looked at will often be the current tenant's books around the period that you're looking to value at material date, what does have to be taken into account there is you can't just assume that they are representative of a hypothetical tenant. So I think that will be an evidential point that will no doubt need to be factored in to the valuation that the exercise the valuers are carrying out. I think this probably, in terms of what other material is drawn on, I'll look to prohibitive to valuers in that context. But no doubt the tenant will want to put forward, when they put their books forward, where they seem to fare in relation to other business. So I've seen it in the case of a pub or club that was being valued, and the tenant was trying to make the point actually that their books weren't representative because of very specific features that pertained to their business. And so that's where, if you're in a tribunal, the valuers may well agree that actually, yes, your business is probably on balance performing 20% better than other types of pubs or clubs in this sort of area because of certain features. If they don't agree on that, then that's going to be a matter that you'll have to put factual evidence in on, which will then factor into no doubt cross-examination such like in the tribunal's assessment of, even if on your books this is what the surplus looks like, what, you know, how much should that be reduced by to reflect the fact that you say that you are not a standard operator, if that makes sense.
Thanks very much, Jacqueline. One final question before we wrap up. We've got a number of lawyers listening in today and a number of surveyors listening in. And valuation is one of those areas of law, perhaps the preeminent area in this field, where you need the expertise of both the surveyor, valuer, and the lawyer if you're going to advance one of these cases in the upper tribunal. Do either of you have any hints or tips on how best surveyors and lawyers can work together to achieve success for the client in rating valuation cases, please?
Shall I deal with that?
Excellent plan.
The golden rule is that each should try and focus on the skills that they have. So a lawyer should focus on legal skills, and the surveyor should focus on valuation and surveying skills. The role of the lawyer in a valuation dispute, in my view, is to ensure, firstly, that the valuation is being put forward properly in accordance with the statutory framework to which I referred in the earlier part of this session. And secondly, to ensure that the valuation that is put forward is one that is logically coherent. The role of the valuer is to ensure that their valuation proceeds in accordance with the guidance as to framework that the lawyer sets out, but then to deploy their own experience and valuation judgment in establishing what the evidence suggests is the correct conclusion as to the annual letting value of the premises in question. Neither should necessarily feel that they have to defer to the other. They should work collaboratively, but recognise those quite distinct disciplines that, in a case that is well presented and well prepared and presented, will complement rather than conflict with each other.
Thanks very much, Tim. And thanks once again to both of our speakers, Tim and Jacqueline, for a fantastic session. Two final things from me, and we'll draw proceedings to a close. First of all, a number of people have been asking about access to notes and so on, access to further information about the series generally. If you'd like to get a copy of any notes that we release, or indeed to find out details of any future events of this kind, which we might be laying on over the coming weeks, if you send an email, please, to rating@landmarkchambers.co.uk, and we'll put you on the mailing list and make sure that we send out any materials to you and generally keep you posted about what's going on. Finally, we have one more session in this series, which is going to be taking place tomorrow, 4 o'clock once again. The details of the Zoom session have been put by Richard, our practice manager for rating, in the group chat. It'll also be on LinkedIn and on the website. That session's going to be dealing with how you litigate all of this, how rating works in practice in the courts and tribunals. As it's the last session, we've got four people lined up to speak. We're going to have Jenny Wigley, Kim Zia, Alex Shattuck, and I'm afraid to say, once again, you'll be hearing a little bit from me. With that said, I'm going to draw proceedings to a close today. Thanks very much to everyone for attending, and I look forward to seeing and hearing from many, hopefully most of you, tomorrow. Thanks very much, everyone. Have a good afternoon.